Hello and welcome to the Spellman Report Phytopharmacology Review. We have an interesting issue for you this month. First, in our new research section, we will discuss eczema and a topical solution used to treat eczema with Sambucus ebulus. Then for our topic of the day, we will discuss the polyphenols, pleiotropic activity, and Big Pharma's reaction to pleiotropy, or what I like to call molecular multitasking. Finally, we will end with a continuation from last month of our interview with David Hoffman, author of a number of popular books, including Medical Herbalism. Now, the study we're going to talk about for Sambucus ebulus is from Farhani, a comparison of the effect of topical preparation of Sambucus ebulus and hydrocortisone on hand eczema, a double-blind randomized controlled trial. And that's in Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine, 2021, volume 27, issue 4. Now, corticosteroids have been the main treatment of hand eczema, but unfortunately, they can cause major side effects. In this study, Farhani and colleagues compared the effect of topical preparation of Sambucus ebulus leaves and hydrocortisone on the severity of hand eczema. But let's talk first about the plant for a moment. Elder, as in Sambucus ebulus, is native to Europe, Northern Africa, and both Western and Central Asia. It has a rich history in each culture as food, medicine, and as folklore. Elderberries have traditionally been used to make syrups, jams, chutneys, juices, cordials, and wine. The flower has also been used to make cordials. A traditional European preparation known as elderberry rob was prepared by simmering 5 pounds of fresh crushed elderberries with 1 pound of sugar until it reached the consistency of honey. This preparation was then used as a nutritive tonic. The berries have additionally been used as an additive to other wines to enhance color or flavor. In terms of the traditional use of elder as medicine, an infusion of elder flowers was traditionally used as a treatment for bronchial and pulmonary ailments. The tea was also believed to promote expectoration in cases of pleurisy. An elderberry rob was a traditional remedy in the treatment of coughs and colds. Key constituents of elder included flavonoids, volatiles, and caffeic acid derivatives. Sambucus species have been documented thus far to have over 200 different phytochemicals. However, as with most medicinal and food plants, there is likely over 1,000 compounds in elder. We just haven't found them all yet. Now, in this particular study, 94 patients with hand eczema aging 18 to 60 years old were recruited in two groups. The two groups were the Sambucus versus the hydrocortisone. Patients were followed for 4 weeks and used topical medications twice a day. Group one was with the typical treatment of topical hydrocortisone, while group two used a topical made with Sambucus ebulus. Physician observations were made at the first visit and also the second and fourth weeks of the study. The primary outcomes were changes in the severity of hand eczema recorded using the Hand Eczema Severity Index, also known as the HECSI, and the Dermatology Life Quality Index, also known as the DLQI. The secondary outcomes were the rate of healing and the severity of itching. Now let's look at the results. In both groups, the HECSI and itching scores decreased over time without any significant difference between the groups. The DLQI scores were significantly better in the Sambucus group after 4 weeks of medication. There was no significant difference between the healing rates of the two groups. The authors concluded that the topical use of Sambucus can be as effective as that of hydrocortisone when it comes to reducing the severity of hand eczema. And now let's turn to the topic of the day. I want to talk about the well-known pleiotropic compounds of so many medicinal plants. If you haven't heard the term pleiotropy before, the definition is producing more than one effect. The term is commonly used in genetics, where it translates as a production by a single gene of two or more apparently unrelated effects. This concept is incredibly important in the medicinal plant field because it turns out that many, if not all, of our well-known active compounds for medicinal plants are pleiotropic. You also hear the term polyvalent used similarly. This term, used in chemistry as far back as the 19th century, originally meant having a chemical valence greater, usually, than two, but has come to mean having more than one activity. Another excellent way of thinking this is the term molecular multitasking, which says it as it is and is a great description of what so many phytochemicals do, interact with many different pharmacological targets. Now let's think this through. What we are saying is that many of the active compounds of medicinal plants have more than one activity. That is, that there are potentially multiple MOAs for key molecular species in herbs. Intriguingly, in pharma, if a molecule hits more than one compound, it is termed a dirty drug. And that pretty much says it all about how our pharmaceutical industry thinks of molecular multitaskers. They think these drugs are not worthy of investigation because of the potential of off-target effects. But let's look at some interesting history, starting with acetylsalicylic acid, better known as aspirin. And now I'm borrowing from Gibbick Carter, Systems Pharmacology and Network Approach to Developing Novel Therapies. And that's in the World Journal of Psychiatry. And that's 2016, and it's volume 6, issue 1. What they point out in the study is the activity of aspirin is extraordinarily pleiotropic. For instance, over 33 different proteins have been shown to be inhibited by aspirin by donating its acetyl group to these targets. One important one being the tumor suppressor protein, P53, which is a known regulator of apoptosis. Other targets include enzymes of the glycolytic pathway, such as glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenase, enolase, aldolase, pyruvate kinase, M2, and lactate dehydrogenase A and B chains, as well as cytoskeletal proteins, histones, ribosomal, and mitochondrial proteins. Aspirin also acetylates enzymes involved in ribonucleotide biosynthesis, such as glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase and transketolase. Additionally, induction of apoptosis by activation of P38 kinases and catabolism of polyamines have been related to anti-cancer mechanisms of aspirin. Regular intake of aspirin has shown to reduce the risk of cancer of the esophagus by 73%, of the colon by 63%, of the stomach by 62%, of the breast and prostate by 39%, and of the lung by 36%. The inhibition of 6-GPDH with increasing concentrations of aspirin is believed to be a crucial event in its anti-cancer effect because this enzyme regulates the synthesis of nucleotides and nucleic acids. Along these lines, the activation of the ERK pathway, mediated by the high levels of RAS mutations observed in many cancers, has been shown to be inhibited by aspirin as well. Anti-proliferative effects have also been reported for actions of salicylic acid that is able to reduce mitochondrial calcium uptake. Finally, aspirin is shown to deactivate Krebs, facilitating its binding to cyclic AMP response element in the promoter of the neurotrophic factor, ciliary neurotrophic factor, and increasing its gene expression. This is just one of many molecular multitaskers. Today, it would probably not get through the FDA investigational new drug application because it is a dirty drug. Now, let's turn to a natural product that's actually a phytochemical that would be called a dirty drug. And now I'm taking from Kahn et al. Molecular targets underlying the anti-cancer effects of quercetin and update. And that's from Nutrients, 2016, Volume 8, Issue 9. Let's look at the neuroprotective effects of quercetin. It alters redox homeostasis and inhibits primary positive effects, competitively inhibits the xanthine oxidase enzyme and non-competitively blocks the xanthine dehydrogenase enzyme. It modulates cell signaling that in turn regulates the action of pro-inflammatory cytokines via what's known as high mobility group box protein 1, also known as HMGB1. It inhibits I-kappa-beta-alpha degradation and nuclear translocation of NF-kappa-B, P65, thus inhibiting NF-kappa-B. It also has an effect on the thymic stromal lymphopoietin, also known as TSLP. Quercetin lowers levels of TSLP, suggesting a treatment plan for various inflammatory diseases. Also in terms of JAK-STAT, that's Janus kinase signal transducers and activators of transcription signaling. Quercetin has the ability to actively inhibit the JAK-STAT signaling pathway in various inflammatory disorders. As for quercetin's anti-cancer activity, it inhibits the phosphatidyl inositol 3 kinase, also known as PI3K, AKT-KB, that's a protein kinase B, pathway in cancer cells. Also, RAF and MAPK extracellular signal-regulated kinases, this is ERK kinase, and MEK, act as direct targets for quercetin, leading to the potential to decrease MEK1 activity. Quercetin also binds with SAPK ERK kinase 1 and c-Jun N-terminal kinase 1, 2, that's JNK 1 and 2, and MEK1 and ERK 1 and 2, blocking cellular growth, spreading, and inducing apoptosis. It decreases AKT phosphorylation, inhibits the activity of telomerase. That's a good thing in cancer. It binds as an antagonist to the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, blocking the CYP production of procarcinogens. It decreases the levels of key oncogenic protein RAS in cancer cells and blocks the cell proliferation and survival. So what does the epidemiological data suggest in terms of the use of quercetin? Well, an inverse correlation exists between the consumption of quercetin found in foods and the development of lung cancer caused by smoking. A multi-ethnic clinical study demonstrated cancer preventative effects of quercetin in the progression of pancreatic cancer in individuals who were chain smokers and non-smokers. The effect was more pronounced in smokers compared to non-smokers, as quercetin imparted its antioxidant activity in smokers who had increased oxidative stress relative to non-smokers. There's increasingly a strong signal coming from a stack of studies that quercetin has beneficial effects against cancer risk. Gates and co-workers from International Journal of Cancer 2007, Volume 21, Issue 10, revealed that quercetin intake had a 29% decrease in ovarian cancer risk compared to women with the lowest intake of quercetin. And now I want to turn to another study, a bit oppositional, and let's talk about this study by Bale and Nisink. It's called the 7-Year Itch Pan-Assay Interference Compounds, PAINS, in 2017, Utility and Limitations. And that's published in ACS Chemical Biology, 2018, Volume 13, Issue 1. And these researchers say, on searching the literature, we were struck by the observation that many of these problematic phytochemicals were known to exhibit varying forms of chemical reactivity and apparent biological activity. We surmise that such behavior could result in positive readouts in biochemical assays via a variety of mechanisms, but that such readouts were not associated with compounds that could be regarded as optimizable and progressible. Now, this is talking about in terms of the drug production track. In other words, what I'm hearing them say is, since our mindset is stuck in the one target, one molecule paradigm, a molecular multitasking agent, which, by the way, is most polyphenols, couldn't possibly be an efficacious pharmacological approach. These authors go on to say, it was for this reason that we coined the term pan-assay interference compounds, which they abbreviate as PAINS. But it's important to realize that this nomenclature is class-based, and individual compounds recognized by a PAINS substructure do not necessarily exhibit broad-spectrum interference. And they go on to say, use of these filters may inappropriately tag a useless compound as worthy of development. So again, they're talking about this drug track. And it's nice to know here that they consider polyphenols, which is basically what they're talking about here in terms of their PAINS, that they consider polyphenols as basically useless compounds. They then admit, I'm quoting, FDA-approved drugs containing PAINS-recognized substructures were discovered in a traditional manner after observation of potent downstream efficacy, not through target-based screening. So what they're saying here is they're putting forward an assumption here that target-based pharmacology is the only way to find a useful drug. This essentially ignores the fact that many drugs have been brought to us through ethnobotanical methods, providing an insight into pathophysiological uses. About 50% of all of our drugs come from natural products, and the majority of those, well over 70% of those, are due to the ethnobotanical uses that they use. In fact, those uses, those ethnobotanical uses, and 70% of those drugs are match what they're used for clinically as they become drugs. So the fact that they insist on target-based, nothing's wrong with that. However, it limits the scope of how we could be producing and finding life-saving and disease-remedying molecules. Now, I want to turn to a dialogue between Dr. Derek Lowe, who is a leader of the pharmaceutical field and has a very well-used and known blog, and Dr. Rick Sheridan, a scientist that is moving his focus to phytochemicals and their potential antiviral effects. And this is from Dr. Rick Sheridan. When anything in a scientific space is difficult to measure, yet has a lot of money and status riding on the outcome, then the thinking among the professionals benefiting from the incumbency in that space inevitably coalesces around schools of thought. Think economic schools or the different flavors of string theory and theoretical physics. This behavior ensures that in the absence of hard evidence, their actions will at least be socially acceptable to peers who can influence things like corporate budget allocations or grant funding. Sheridan goes on to say, by interfering in many assays readouts, compounds like polyphenolics effectively serve as a blind spot to medicinal chemists' work, which is why they don't like them. Rather than be creative and think up and verify new assays that can accurately assess these compounds' capabilities or cut straight to animal model research in the face of a high-priority pandemic, it's much easier to slap a label like pains on them and catcall them all at once in order to focus on other compounds. Then Sheridan closes with a quote, and this quote is, "What do you have to say about the principal philosophers of this academy who are filled with the stubbornness of an asp and do not want to look at either the planets, the moon, or this telescope, even though I have freely and deliberately offered them the opportunity 1,000 times? Truly, just as the asp stops its ears, so do these philosophers shut their eyes to the light of truth." And that quote is from Galileo. Now, let's turn to Derek Lowe's response to Sheridan. So you have things that hit in the in vitro assays, but hit in a lot of them, suggesting a lot of different activities and side effects, and don't tend to have in vivo effects because they get cleared so easily. Now, just a quick note before we go on here. So the in vivo activity is well established for a lot of flavonoids, such as quercetin. And speaking of quercetin, Derek Lowe goes on to say, "Quercetin, for its part, has been in so many assays and so many animal models that I couldn't count them all. It has, to the best of my knowledge, never delivered any useful activity against any particular disease or condition." Again, my commentary here, this basically shows either a true ignorance of the pharmacological literature or reluctance to break out of his frame of mind that pleiotropic molecules could be useful. To him, a dirty drug can't possibly be useful, it appears to me. However, a quick search shows over 280 clinical trials that have been done on quercetin. And let's go back to Dr. Sheridan's response. One well-known natural product, albeit not a polyphenolic one, artemisinin, gets cleared in just 2 to 5 hours of time. At any given time, preclearance, just thousands of the oral dose are extant in the bloodstream. And yet that's plenty for it to do the work of inhibiting malaria's Plasmodium falciparum over a 5-day course. By my back-of-the-envelope calculations on our World in Data's malaria stats, there are up to 5 million sub-Saharan Africans still with us today who would be glad that any concerns about rapid in vivo clearance did not arrest artemisinin's development in the drug pipeline. And he makes an excellent point here. Short half-lives don't necessarily equate with no physiological activity. And so what we see in this conversation is classic. What we see is the disagreement between two schools of thought, one around natural products, that they could be useful, and that pleiotropy, that molecular multitasking, is a quality that is useful. And another that insists that if a compound hits a lot of different targets, it couldn't possibly be useful, and it's in the way of us producing drugs. To support the polyphenol argument, let's turn to flavonoids again here. And I want to highlight the study by Putaraj et al. This is flavonoids and its neuroprotective effects on brain ischemia and neurodegenerative diseases. This is from Current Drug Targets 2018, Volume 19, Issue 14. And these authors write, brain ischemia is among the leading cause of death, with majority of the cases are associated with ischemic strokes. It can occur in two forms of either focal or global ischemia. Neurodegenerative disorders such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease is also on the rise worldwide. These disorders have common similarities. They all are affecting the central nervous system with debilitating effect to the patient. We look into the promising role of flavonoids, a natural bioactive compound found abundant in vegetables, fruits, and traditional herbs. Treatment with flavonoids such as curcumin, and by the way, curcumin is not a flavonoid. These authors made an error here. Lycopene, also not a flavonoid. Ginsenoside, also not a flavonoid. Bifotexin, yes, a flavonoid. Bicalin, yes, a flavonoid. Have shown promising neuroprotective effects against ischemic-induced injury. Besides anti-cancer, antioxidant, and immunomodulation properties, flavonoids also exert neuroprotective effects by increasing neuronal viability, increasing tissue perfusion and cerebral blood flow, and reducing ischemic-related apoptosis. In addition, flavonoids also exert anti-amyloidogenic effect and reduces loss of dopaminergic neurons in the brain. These results suggest flavonoids might be able to serve as a potential therapeutic agent in brain disorders. Just to put another stroke into this, let's look at Arab and Libeskind. Their title of their article, T, Flavonoids and Stroke in Man and Mouse, and that's from the Archives of Biochemical and Biophysics. Now, these researchers evaluated the strength of the in vivo evidence of the relationships between flavonoids and the risk of stroke. And their search of epidemiological publications revealed 7 cohort studies in flavonoid intake and stroke, and 7 cohort studies and 3 case control studies on T and stroke. These studies showed a consistent protective effect. In addition, 11 animal experiments were identified that examined T or T components and stroke relevant sequelae. Studies demonstrated reduced infarct volumes in animals exposed either to T extracts, theanine, or T catechins prior to or shortly after reperfusion. And these authors comment a high level of consistency across preclinical studies of the effect of T components as single agents effective in reducing stroke volume after middle cerebral arterial occlusion is noted in all rodent models. Reductions in infarct volume are seen with both T extracts consumed orally and T components introduced intraperitoneally. Observational epidemiological supports this finding in humans for T. So finally, let's put the final stroke in here. And this is an excellent study by Howitz and Sinclair. And that's David Sinclair as in resveratrol guy. And this is from Cell 2008, volume 133, issue 3. And it's called Xenohormesis Sensing the Chemical Cues of Other Species. The Xenohormesis hypothesis of Howitz and Sinclair proposes that primordial species synthesize polyphenol molecules to stimulate sirtuins during times of stress. Plants have retained this ability. So what are sirtuins? Sirtuins are a family of proteins that regulate cellular health, and they play a key role in regulating cellular homeostasis. And Sinclair made $1 billion by patenting some compounds from his research showing life extension via SIRT6, sirtuin-6. They go on to say survival pathways in fungi and animals have retained the ability to respond to plant stress signaling molecules because they provide useful prediction about the state of the environment and or food supply. This ability would allow organisms to prepare for and survive adversity when they might otherwise perish. Now, this xenohormesis hypothesis is big and it's broad, and it really has to do with an evolutionary perspective. Given that this appears to be a selected response to our environment and that pleiotropy is extraordinarily common for compounds that the plant uses for protection, it seems that we really ignore the evolutionary selective protective MOA at our own peril. Turns out that polyphenols and pains, as the pharma industry calls them, are particularly useful. And now let's turn to part 2 of David Hoffman's lecture. And once again, his bio, he's a fellow of Britain's National Institute of Medical Herbalists. He's been a phytotherapist for 45 years. He graduated in biological science from Sussex University in 1973. And after clinical training, became a member of the National Institute of Medical Herbalists in 1978. He was elevated to fellowship of the Institute in 1995. After moving to the U.S. in 1986, he became the director of the California School of Herbal Studies after Rosemary Gladstar and is still on faculty. He is one of the 12 founding members and a past president of the American Herbalist Guild. David is the author of 14 books translated into 9 languages. His latest is a textbook on the science of herbal medicine and its therapeutic application in clinical practice entitled Medical Herbalism, a peripatetic teacher to herb schools as well as academic institutions and frequent presenter at conferences throughout the English-speaking world. In 2004, he joined Traditional Medicinals as chief formulator and is now their principal scientist. So after being a clinical phytotherapist forever, he now has commented that he has discovered the garden and he's actually an herbalist. You brought up a lot of really good points. And one of them is that a lot of herb corporations, the small companies are different for the most part, but a lot of herb corporations don't even have an herbalist on staff. They don't have an herb hero to really tell people about what this is really about. I know I have dealt with a number of companies that their buyers really don't know what they're buying. And that to me is very problematic.
Yeah. Yeah. We're really blessed at TM with our history and our current people. Founded by Rosemary and Drake Sadler. So it's founded by some of the best folk vision going. And the sourcing and all of that stuff has really been focused through Joseph Brinkman over the last who knows how many years. We've set up supply chains, and everybody could do this, but we've actively set up supply chains where we know everybody on the chain. We know what fields our stuff comes from, which gets really difficult when we're talking about hundreds of tons a year, but still we maintain that. And it's possible to do everything you need to do for supply chain manufacturing and selling and keep ethical. It's possible. It's hard work, but it's possible. If your issue is, oh, dietary supplements are making money, let's get in there. It's possible to make lots of money, rip people off, and change your company's name very quickly. There are wonderful people in the industry who largely come from the old days, who set up companies that get young, wonderful people. But the herb corporations and the corporate bodies which have bought out the small herb companies, they really don't care. As long as the FDA is not going to give them a hard time, they'll do whatever they need to do to make money, not to maintain standards.
Yeah, I agree. Stockholders don't have an appetite for quality.
Right.
That's the way I would put it.
Talk to trustees from our corporation, even though it's still family run with Drake and so on, that there are corporate people there who really wanted good herbal treatment for themselves. And they were the people who were most pushing the company towards the corporate model. And they had not made the real meaningful connection between their needs, which of course they're going to fulfill, and the potential needs of our consumers. We could be making them healthier if we had that corporate vision rather than profit. So we were able to talk to those trustees, and they've changed their minds now and they get it. But there's a disconnect between personal needs and your business corporate need. And that is so dangerous and so unhealthy.
We're seeing it all kinds of industries, unfortunately, in the U.S. But one of the things you had talked about in a previous conversation we had was herb teas building resilience. And I'd like to explore that a little bit with you. Resilience has become this concept that physicians use. It's a fuzzy concept, fuzzy logic concept, I think, for physicians. But I think for people on the ground that are dealing with difficult life.
Yeah. One of the reasons I've started to use that word has been COVID, because it's one of the obvious things it's shown is the American business infrastructure and healthcare infrastructure is not resilient. So the word has been thrown up from those positions. I have always used it herbally internally in my head, not used it in classes because it doesn't really get understood. What we're talking about is, all right, this is a problem between mainstream practitioners and, dare I say, fringe people like me. So I put a lot of attention on tonics, on nutrition, on non-flashy pharmacology, if I can talk like that, because there is a lot of really clever pharmacology and biochemistry in herbalism. Yes. So if you start relating to that and then invoke resilience, the question which comes up is, where's the evidence? And there isn't any, because how do you really look at resilient outcomes? You know, there's palliative care and all of that stuff, but it's not the most studied of areas. So I actually said that the wrong way. I think it would be straightforward to do good outcome studies on the whole area of resilience, but no one is really funding that area. So clinicians who need to know, is this resilient approach successful? When they turn to their evidence-driven databases, they're not going to find very much. So my approach, or the stance I take, is trusting some old herbal approaches which have equivalences all over the world, which are ignored by the system. So let me put it really simply as an example, than rather than trying to sound coherent. I would suggest that possibly if we were drinking nettle tea daily or some other green leafy local tonic safe plant, if that sort of stuff was back in our daily routine instead of coffee, we would find a change in overview statistics of what illnesses the population gets 10, 15 years down the line. I think there would be less chronic skin problem. There still would be arthritis, of course, but slightly less numbers, starting at a later age, less severity. Now, I cannot prove any of that. I think it would be straightforward with a well-funded study to start approaching herbs that way. But if we look at traditional ways of maintaining health, if we would be introducing them into our healthcare system as things to use, things to take, they would help. But there is another form of resilience that herbalism directly supports. All right, we're going through this situation in California where we're only just getting the injections for COVID because of all the ice storms in Texas, non-resilient distribution systems. So what if this had got, not about COVID, but just in general, the system was, distribution was breaking down because of lack of petroleum or because of crazed fascists in the Midwest? Forgive me if I've just offended someone, but they're there. We've got to be aware that all these weird things are coming. So rather than my local community, the doctors and the pharmacists and the patients getting freaked out because they can't get anything, they've got lots of things. They've got herbal teas. They've got herbalists with tinctures. They've got all sorts of gentle, reasonably effective medicines for helping first line of help. Not hospital level help. That's not what this is about. But to help make families a little bit more resilient so they don't freak out as quickly or as much. I'm feeling really incoherent at the moment, but hopefully you're getting where I'm going. I think if the pharmacists knew about the existence of local herbalists, a good pharmacist has been trained in some degree of herbalism. And compounding pharmacists are really good herbal medicine makers when they allow themselves to be. They were trained in that. So as soon as they know that we're around. And in Sonoma County, they do, because, you know, they all come do our classes. We're all friends. But this could be everywhere. The pharmacists would be the doorway into the community for resilient, supporting herbs. So I think in those ways, looking into the future, the time for cultural herbalism is really coming. Some places it's already here. Many places there is a major herbal support network that the system knows nothing about, which on one level, that's unfortunate because they should. But on another level, I totally understand why herbalists keep their heads down. There's no need in California. There is in Ohio. There is in Oklahoma. So really good herbalism going on there, but you won't find it being talked about in public.
Agreed. And we've got a situation where I completely agree with you, where if we were using certain tonics daily or even a couple of times a week, we could potentially change the outcome over a long term. And I think that's what's missed in medicine. And funding a study that actually goes for more than 10 or 15 years in itself, you're talking about probably two generations of scientists and multiple generations of funding, and it just becomes incredibly difficult. But I completely agree with you. If we were to embrace herbal medicine as real, as true tonics, which we don't really, Ayurveda and Chinese medicine have concepts for this. Native American medicine has concepts for this, but we don't in modern medicine, right?
Yeah, right.
There's much to learn, I think, from herbal medicine.
There was a study started off, I think, in the 50s, maybe the 60s, in Leiden, Holland, or the Netherlands, looking at the whole population of this town and following what happens with heart disease, et cetera, over 30, 40, 50 years, and relating that to good case history taking about diet and all that basic stuff. And some wonderful insights have come out of that. I know it from the flavonoid implications, but really good mainstream epidemiology sites. I would like to see the same equivalent thing done by following a group, a large group of people who live in the real world and at the same time are doing the right herbal things. So they take drugs if they need to. They'll do surgery if they need to. But their diet includes echinacea or whatever. Actually, it wouldn't include echinacea. That's not for daily use. It would be things like nettles, chamomile, things which on the surface don't have dramatic pharmacology and therefore are not of interest to the pharmaceutical industry and therefore not of interest to the MDs. Though if they look at it objectively,
right, exactly.
Of interest.
I completely agree. Now, one of the plants that you've talked about that really you helped introduce, I think, in the United States was Scalidium.
Well, it's definitely part of good herbal practice, and it is safe. There's been some really interesting, maybe I should give some background. Right, Scalidium tortuosum is a plant from South Africa that I was part of the group that introduced it. I think the main person who has introduced it, it's unusual to know the person who did introduce it, but it's Thomas Brendler. He's done wonderful work on it. Now, it contains some alkaloids, which I'll pronounce wrong, mesembrianthines, I think, from mesembrianthemum originally, even though Scalidium isn't one of them. The old hippie in me is going to be talking now. They're very pleasant antidepressants, very pleasant mood lifters, but anything that does that herbally is potentially a worry because of drug abuse. Not a worry to me, but a worry to the people who worry about that stuff. So one of the international drug monitoring agents that works with the United Nations, the name of which I forget, I've got it on my hard drive, but I haven't got it in front of me. They come out with a report every 2 years of new drugs. And All right. An aside, anybody who wants to discover new drugs, get this regular report. They have everything. Absolutely everything. I'm surprised they're allowed to publish it. But they did a reasonable toxicity study of these alkaloids. They came to the conclusion the plant has no worrying issues around it because the alkaloids build up tolerance very rapidly. You can't ramp up the high. You get a change of mood, which is quite pleasant, and it lasts. You may be able to do it again with another cup, but then you won't be able to. It would take a day before you can take it again. There's no toxicity that's been found from the drug. So what I'm actually suggesting these days is that we have a legal, safe psychoactive, very mild one, that lifts mood in a way that I'm not aware of any other herb doing. There's no come down. You don't feel sedated. If you're anxious when you drink it, you'll feel not just lack of anxiety. Some anti-anxiolytics raise your spirit a bit, as opposed to changing your mood. You know you're feeling better. It does that to you very slightly. All round, it's a very pleasant thing. Some of us would want more of that very pleasant thing. It won't let you. So it will work every day, but it won't work as a, I'm going to a party now. It just won't do that. The dose is absolutely minute. Trying to get it into a tea bag, we had to work out how to dilute it with other herb so that we got the right amount in each bag. Statistically, it's so close to nothing being in there because of the potent chemicals. We had to be able to demonstrate to FDA we actually were getting it in each bag because otherwise the manufacturing was really difficult. So I've seen this being given now to adults. It's most appropriate, I think, for adults, especially older adults, who've got things to be pissed off about. They're getting old. You know what it's like. This is a very safe way of taking the edge off that. I have come across a few people it's done absolutely nothing for. I mean, that's the way with herbs. If somebody tries it and it does nothing, taking more won't help. You either have, I don't know, the receptor, whatever, or you don't. I don't know what the issue is there. And also, I've never used it with children. We had an opinion given from a toxicologist in England, and they gave it a clean bill of health. But that's not the point for me. I don't want to be giving anything psychoactive to people under the age of 14. I mean, my generation, we grew up as young kids in better living through chemistry. So we're all trained to take things. And it's been the bane of my life and many of my friends. We have to actively not do it. So I don't want, as a herbalist, to generate more kids who take things. Even if they're herbal, taking things is last resort.
I like the way you said that. I'm going to tweak it a little bit. Better living through phytochemistry, I think, is a way to think of it as well.
Oh, your T-shirt, yes.
That's right. Tell me about Paganum Harmala. Have you played with that at all?
Only
Syrian rue.
Yeah. Only in areas we shouldn't really be talking about. I know people who've used it. Have you come across pharmahuasca? You know, the concept of making ayahuasca from... Yeah. So even though, obviously, it's a plant, it's relatively common, and I've come across it being used that way, which is fair enough. But I've never actually tried it from its potential therapeutic use.
I have heard from friends that a little addition of paganum to psilocybe mushrooms is a good synergist.
Oh, that makes sense. You know, I can never decide.
Yeah, it does.
Whether it's psilocybe or psilocybe. Do you actually know which of those two is the real creation?
I actually don't know. I've heard both. And some of the more prolific speakers are now saying psilocybe. Some are saying psilocybe. I don't know what the right term is.
Yeah. All right. I got into an argument, an interaction with someone actually up at Bastia. He was telling me really intensely that the English do not pronounce the H in herbalist, herb, all that stuff. And he just did not get that I was English. And everybody else in the room did. Really, really silly.
Were you giving a lecture at the time or something?
Yeah. This actually, it's when they were in the old building, you know, the old Victorian school, which was really interesting. So I must have sounded much more English then than I do now. But
that's hilarious. Well, David, I really appreciate your time today. We've covered a lot of ground, and it's been fun. And I have the greatest respect to you. For those who don't know about the book Medical Herbalism, it's a standard and found in hopefully all herb schools. I know most herb schools anyway, which David is the author of. And we appreciate your time today. Best of luck to you, and may you survive COVID well.
And you. So goodbye, everyone.